The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of The Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hey friends, and welcome once again to my program. I am so glad to have you along with me, and happy to have my friend Rick Brunson on the line. Rick has been a guest on my show back in the days when we actually got to meet face-to-face and do these shows that way. Today is not that kind of day. We're still in the quarantine, and we've been doing this now. Rick, I've been doing these shows like this since, I think, March 26th. About 3 years ago is how long that began.
What it feels like.
It's what it feels like. It really does. It's crazy. I was telling Mark Goldstein on my program yesterday that, some friend of mine wrote a meme and it said, he was so happy. He said, I'm glad April's over because it was a long year.
Exactly.
I feel that way. It feels like it's been 10 years since we got to go out to restaurants. And, I know so many people are just praying that we can get into a better place with the handling of, the virus. And everybody wants everybody to be safe. But I think everybody is ready for a normalcy of some sort, even if it's this new normal. But we're all ready for whatever that is to come around and move on and get on with our business world. And boy, Rick, you're a professor at UCF. I know this thing has really affected you. Tell us about the impact, how it first came to you, and then what you've had to do since.
First of all, Mike, thank you so much for having me on, and thank your audience, your listeners who are taking the time today out of their day to listen to our conversation. I appreciate that, and it's so kind of you to have me on. It was spring break at UCF, where I teach journalism in the Nicholson School of Communication and Media. During spring break, it started around March the 9th, we began getting emails that instruction was probably going to be moving toward online. And because of the coronavirus, as more and more cases begin to pop up closer and closer to and in Florida, into Central Florida, the university was making rapid preparations to protect the university community, which is huge. I mean, we have 68,000 students alone. So we're a small city, in and of itself. And we're dense. We're a large university, one of the largest in the country. And a lot of our courses, our classes, are taught in large auditoriums with hundreds of people. And so that was a situation that was just ripe for a really bad situation if the virus got loose on our campus. So the university moved really quickly to try to pivot to and toggle to online instruction. So that was early in the week, and by I believe it was March the 11th, the university announced and flipped the switch that, hey, we're going to completely remote online instruction for at least 2 weeks, starting March the 16th. So you need to get your courses, any face-to-face courses that you have, moved to online by that date. So I had a few days, because this semester all four of my classes have been face-to-face. So I had to, in about a matter of 4 days, move four face-to-face classes completely to an online setting in an online environment so that they were ready to go on March 16th. Keep in mind that students had been away on spring break, so there was a real concern that as students were, in far-flung places of the country and even the world during spring break, that they could conceivably bring the virus back to campus and it could quickly spread. So the move was really quick, and to move everything online. So I had to have all of that ready by March 16th. And from then until the end of the semester, and now even through the summer, I continue to teach online completely, 100%.
You know, that's, it's so crazy that we have the technology to even have an option like that. There was a day not that many years ago when that would not have been even a possibility.
Oh, I know. I can't imagine doing this without the internet. I mean, just in terms of numbers, a friend of mine who is a researcher at the university had posted that as of March 23rd, that close to 5,000 courses at UCF went from face-to-face to online, just mm-hmm. that quick in a matter mm-hmm. of days. Almost 5,000 courses, and all of the students in those courses went from face-to-face to online just that quickly.
You know, when I think back to when I was in school, and yes, Virginia, there were schools when I went to school. Sometimes it seems like it might have been those little one-room schoolhouses, but I remember it had to be just a technological breakthrough back in the day. We had TV science. And it was one of these things where all of the kids in our class, and I went to a big school, you know, there were 2,000 kids in the school, 500 seniors, and I was a senior. So I think this course was when I was a freshman, but so there were still 500 in our group. And I think they divided it up something to where they would have had maybe one of these large rooms where there probably was 80 to 100 kids. And we would be in this big meeting room. It was the cafeteria, actually, where they rolled in 6 TVs. Now, you know, back in that day, that would have been the late 60s. They had to be no bigger than 19-inch TVs. And they Wow. rolled these things out, and we watched TV science. Each of us getting as close to a TV as they would. They were all in these roll around carts. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Our kids today, you know, the difference in technology in that day and today is incredible.
Well, and UCF has been teaching online courses since the mid 90s. So, a good majority of the faculty are certified. We have a certification course for teaching online at UCF. Matter of fact, for about 18 months, I helped co-teach it, co-facilitate it. So a lot of our faculty are certified as online instructors. So it's not so much that it was a shock in terms of doing it and the actual pedagogy of teaching online as much as it was for those of us who were just teaching face-to-face. You know, you have to move and quickly. It's kind of like bugging out in a war zone, you know. Yeah, the logistics of it, crafting a lesson that you would normally teach face to face. How do you move that into a different kind of asynchronous environment where the student is, you know, accessing the course content online rather than right there in front of you, and try to make it as effective of a learning experience for the student and the end user as it is face to face. So that I think that's the challenge, how to make what you're doing face to face as good or maybe if you can even better in an online environment. So just like, you know, in this quarantine, Mike, you've had to go home and you've turned, you know, a one of your rooms into your studio. Mm-hmm. I did the same thing here at home. One of my upstairs bedroom, Ruth and I are empty nesters. So we have a spare bedroom upstairs, and I turned it into my video studio. And so every day I was recording video lessons up there. I had an edit bay set up so that my lectures, I could shoot, edit, and produce up there. I did a lot of two-way conversations with professional journalists of mine who were in the field who were covering this pandemic. It was a great teachable moment. I have a good friend who was actually the disaster reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And she was flitting all about the country, going to the hot zones where the bulk of the cases have been, reporting from those locations. And she was kind enough to chat with me and I could do a video lecture with her. I have a good friend who covered the Iraq War, 3 tours of duty in Iraq, And we made comparisons. What's it like to cover a war zone? What's it like to cover a pandemic? What are some of the same challenges? And he was kind enough to sit in with me and provide some real excellent lessons and learning opportunities for my students. And we did it all online.
Now, when they're in the war zones like that, when they're covering from Iraq or Afghanistan, I mean, obviously there's, I would think, a crew, at least one other camera person that's there. And so the person is at least who's doing that report. Obviously, he's right in the middle of a very dangerous environment. And yet there is one other human being. When you're doing your teaching, for the most part, you're there and there's a camera in front of you. And that has to be so completely different when you're used to teaching in a classroom and you've got the real-time eyes looking back at you, the interaction, just even the sense of another human being there. How has that been, making that transition?
It's interesting, Mike. We've used, and all of us now are probably Zoom experts, right? Because we've all used Zoom to socialize and to meet and to conduct business and so many different other contexts. It's interesting when you're trying to teach on Zoom and you're trying to manage the chat space, you know, there on the right-hand side of your screen. You're trying to stay engaged with your eyes and your face and your nonverbal communication and your nonverbal cues with all of your students and all of those little blocks and tiles that you're seeing on your screen. It's a different kind of classroom management.
Okay, so basically your classes still, you do have then the face-to-face virtual through Zoom then.
In some, like in my large lecture class, I couldn't because I have 90 students in that
class.
So,
okay.
So, and Zoom puts a cap on how many people you can have in a space. But in the smaller classes where I have 17, 18 students, yes, we were able to meet occasionally on Zoom and stay in touch that way.
I was thinking you were just saying you had a video camera set up and you're looking at the camera lens and doing teaching. And I think, wow, that is so hard, because that's what a lot of churches now have been doing on Sundays when they're streaming. And boy, I know the pastors that I've talked to and, of course, a part of my own church that's doing that. The difference in teaching or preaching and you're looking at a camera as opposed to a congregation, it's just, or a classroom in your case, it is just completely different, isn't it?
It is, and I'll tell you what the greatest challenge has been, Mike, and I think it's funny that we're talking today, because this morning I got my course evaluations back. You know, the students evaluate us anonymously, and they can say whatever they want because their names aren't attached to us, and they rate us. And I got my course evaluations back this morning, and I was a little bit nervous because, you know, I didn't know what those were going to look like. And frankly, you know, our students, many of them work in the service sector. A lot of them have lost their jobs. You know, they work for restaurants and parts of the economy that have just been completely decimated. Many of them have been forced to move back in with their parents. Some of them are taking care of parents, and I, you know, and on top of that, managing their classes. So I didn't know what this thing was going to look like just because the students have been through the ringer. And I was very gratified that, and I'm not trying to brag here, it's just a number, that 90% of my students gave me an overall rating of excellence as an instructor. And the two biggest trends that came in from the comments was that, number one, that the transition was seamless and they felt like they didn't get left behind. But the second biggest one is that they felt like I cared about them. And I think that was the biggest challenge. When you don't have office hours anymore where students can come in and see you if they have a problem or they have a concern, or you're not talking to them in the hallway, or you're not talking to them, you know, after class in the classroom, you can easily lose that connection. And so I made a very conscious effort to reach out to individual students, either by FaceTime, by Skype, by Zoom, or just by good old-fashioned phone call to check on them and see how they were doing. Because I was really concerned about them feeling isolated and feeling abandoned and alone. And so I had to make extra effort to do just what I called wellness checks, you know, mm-hmm. on a lot of my students to see how they were doing. And in the end, I think that mattered to them as much, if not more, than even the quality of instruction. So they want to know you care. And isn't that true of most human beings of any kind? They just want to know that you care and that you don't see them as just, someone who's paying the tuition, but they're human beings who are living through a very unreal, surreal, unprecedented moment in our nation's history, in our world's history. And they just want to know somebody, they want to know somebody cares. So,
well, you know, when you talk about something as unprecedented as what COVID-19 has been, it really does tax that whole aspect of our feelings. And we all know now nobody likes to think of themselves as being weak or so emotionally tapped. But if there has ever been a scenario that does tap people that way and really stretch us to the max, it has been this one. On so many different levels, where just literally even a trip to the grocery store is now a much bigger deal than it used to be. And who of us ever thought that we would encounter potential danger just by walking down the produce aisle, for crying out loud? I mean, it is that kind of a thing. So what I'm hearing you say is that your love and your care, it's translating, Rick, even though it's over virtual lines of communication like Zoom or even a video camera or whatever, however it is, they're getting it that you care. And I think of that Bible verse that says, know the condition of your flock. Now, we know that means it's talking about a shepherd and a pastor perhaps in his congregation, but boy, that really does apply for you too, to know the condition of your students.
I do, and I appreciate that analogy and that metaphor, because that really is how I see my students and my classes, is that I care for them. I'm an educator, but ultimately I'm in the people development business, and these are people. Every one of them who God loves, who God cares for. And if I can get that across to them in a way that is real to them, that they are cared for, that they are loved, that they are appreciated uniquely as individuals. And it is, I think, harder work to do that virtually and online than face to face, and when you're in somebody's presence. So it is something that I've had to work harder at communicating, and like a lot of people, I am employed. I have a job. I have meaningful work. I hope no one interprets this as any kind of complaint. But I do feel like I have worked harder in the last 8 weeks than I did in the previous 8 weeks. It's just being home and being quarantined and doing this all from home has actually felt more exhausting, if that makes any sense.
Oh, I think it is. Yeah. Because most of us are not nearly as active. I began a different diet today because I've encountered what I'm calling and I picked this up from one of my kids, the quarantine bloat is what I'm feeling, because I'm just not moving around enough, you know, and it's just like, wow, this is crazy. I've got to change. I've got to become more purposeful. And for you, I can see how that, as a teacher, you had to reinvent yourself in terms of your teaching style and your teaching habit, and even your approach to every day had to be completely different. Why, my goodness, that is exhausting. And it's
well, and think, Mike, think of our friends who are teaching K through 12, who, especially in the elementary grades, you know, they do some online teaching in high school and in middle school, but at the elementary level, my friends who are teachers in K through five, where they rarely, if ever, do any kind of online teaching, and you're dealing with young children and you're trying to coach parents. Now, you know, we know a lot of folks who've homeschooled their mm-hmm. kids, so they've been doing this a long time and they're used to it. And But for parents who've never had to do it before, you know, the teachers having to coach the parents and the kids, and my hat is off to them, because I can't imagine, if I'm tired, I can't imagine how exhausted they are. And, you know, dealing with their own children at home and trying to manage them and manage their education, it's everybody is just tired and wrung out.
Well, everybody now can really appreciate those homeschoolers like my wife. And my wife and I began our homeschooling adventure in 1985. And I am so grateful for Cindy's dedication to it, and our children when they all became I think it was when my daughter graduated, my youngest daughter, Allie, graduated from Santa Fe. She was she was like dual enrolled is what they called it back then. But she was also had also been in the Florida virtual school. But when she graduated with her AA degree and was actually done with all of the dual enrollment classes, all of my kids got together and they did a big party for Cindy one night afterwards after an event, and they all presented her a bouquet of roses, and it was beautiful, and saying, "Thank you, Mom, for all those years." And I can tell you that there are a lot of moms who didn't realize at the beginning of this school year that they were going to be homeschoolers. They've been thrust into it. My heart goes out for them. I know how exhausting, speaking of exhaustion, that has been for them. Rick, I saw a funny meme, and it was a picture of an elderly lady, and it was said, meet Sally. She's a new homeschooler. She's only 35. and it was obviously a picture of someone much older than that. And that's exactly the tiredness impact that a lot of our moms and dads who are homeschooling, and when they didn't expect to, but that is that is going to be something that they have as a story that they're going to be able to tell future generations. I remember when. And if they might be doing it longer than they thought. But there's one question before we take a break I wanted to get from you. You mentioned this about the people like your students who are members of the service industry. There have been segments of business that, in your words, have been decimated, just completely gutted from the standpoint of their employment, and furloughing has been going on. There have been people furloughed from their jobs. I know of some high-level people that were in upper echelons of management and in restaurant business that was cut out and just went to work in March and found out that at the end of the day, they didn't have a job. How are you seeing, particularly the younger students that you have, how are they handling all of this that's going on?
By and large, you know, and people are individuals, and it's like, you know, each person kind of can respond differently. But I would say on the whole, when I have done these wellness checks with my students, in almost every case, Mike, someone in the household has lost a job, whether that's the student themselves or a sibling or a parent. Someone in the household has almost in every case has lost their job. And then in the face of that, I have been amazed at the evidence of resiliency that I've seen in my students in the face of this. And I wrote a piece about this for WFTV, where I'm employed part-time as the writing coach, last week, about, you know, this generation. And I don't like to generalize about generations, because I don't think you can put any generation, like, you know, fit them into some kind of a hole. But when you think about it, this generation, these kids, their first early television images were of the smoldering rubble of the Twin Towers in New York in 9/11. And then as they got older and we went through the Great Recession, they saw many of their parents lose their jobs or some lost homes. So, you know, often they're denigrated as snowflakes or apathetic or lazy and lackadaisical, but they really have seen a lot in their short lifetimes. And now they're seeing this and they're living through this. And I've been so heartened that instead of just curling up in a ball, you know, on their couch, and they've really just kind of stared this thing straight in the eye and seen it for what it is. And like all of us, you know, everybody has had to make some kind of sacrifice or inconvenience, or even in the case, if they've lost their job, they get it and kind of understand that as a country, we've had to make these mitigations to, you know, as awful as the amount of death is that we've had, this could have been so much worse if we hadn't, you know, taken these mitigations. And they get that and they understand it. And for the most part, they're rolling with it. But they do miss socializing with their friends. They do miss being together. And they would like to get back to that as soon as we safely can.
Well, I think we can relate to that, and we agree with that, and we're all there. I'm ready for it to happen today. So that's not going to happen quite yet, but we're praying for it. My guest today, if you've just tuned in, is Rick Brunson. He is a professor at UCF. And also, as you just heard him say, if you've been around the last few minutes, he is a writing coach over at Channel 9 WFTV Orlando. And he is a great guy on top of all of that. And he's my guest today. And I thank you for being with us, friends. And we're going to be back with Rick coming up in a moment. This is Afternoons with Mike here on The Shepherd. Back on the line again here with Rick Brunson. And Rick is a professor of journalism at UCF. And he's also a journalism writing coach at Channel 9 in Orlando. I've known Rick for years. Boy, Rick, it's been a long time, 18, 19 years. I've actually known you longer than that, but in terms of close friendship, about that long. And my goodness, these are times that, as we talked about in the last segment, they're just so taxing. And for many people, they believe that, you know, it's the first time there's ever been anything like this. But the truth of it is, there was a pandemic, what was called the pandemic, in 1968, and it was the H3N2 virus, and it was nicknamed the Hong Kong flu. And I wonder if people would be surprised to realize that 1 million people across the world died from the Hong Kong flu in 1968. And I think that would probably come to a lot of people, especially younger people who weren't even born then. They'd be surprised at that. And they say, I never heard about it. And, you know, I wonder if that's because we don't have any of the kind of communication systems back then that we do today. You think that has a role in it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was no social media in 1968. And social media has amplified everything in our own time. I mean, information, both good information and misinformation or disinformation, just spread. I'm not trying to be a you know, punny here, but information is viral now. I mean, we're living in the time of a virus, and information is viral now because of social media. So we flat out just know more. We're aware of more, just because, you know, all of us are carrying around what I call the newsroom in our hands. I mean, with smartphones and with social media, you can't help but know about things. It's coming to you. It's pinging at you. It's clamoring for your attention. And so there's no way not to know. But that said, things become a lot more amplified because there's just a lot more information. In 1968, you had what, 3 television networks maybe to choose from?
Maybe your 4 local, if you count PBS.
Your local paper, some radio stations, and that's what we knew about what was going on in the world. Now, I mean, there's a bazillion websites, a bazillion social media accounts, and in any given day, there is, you know, since the pandemic, everybody's talking about it, sharing information about it, distributing and sharing things. And so we just know more about it. And like I said, there's good information out there, and then there's just completely wrong disinformation out there. And it all goes equally viral. And Mark Twain, I think it was, it says, was famously said, a lie can travel halfway around the world before the truth gets up from bed and puts its shoes on. Mm. And that's definitely true of our, if it was true in his time, think of how true it is in our time when it just, information just pings and zings around the world with such rapidity, thanks to social media.
Well, I know that there has, in our lifetime, Rick, there's probably never been a more important time to pray for our leaders. Those that are governing at any level, even if it's a mayor or a governor or, and of course, all the way to our national leaders, the senators, the congressmen, the president. These are times to pray for those over us because they are having to deal with a very serious problem. And what you've just described, the difference that social media has added to the mix, there, you know, we've all had opinions for years. Everybody in 1968, people had opinions, but they weren't quite as vocal and they weren't quite as focal. They weren't quite as viewed.
Everybody had opinions, but you didn't have a means or a method to exercise your opinion. I mean, unless you wanted to write a letter to the editor or write a letter to your friend or whatever. But I liken social media to this, and you and I are friends on social media, so I use it. It's not, I'm there, I have a presence. It's not like I eschew it or disdain it at all. But what social media has done is given everybody a bullhorn. But that also means that there's more bull out there.
That's well said.
Everybody has a bullhorn, but there's also a lot of bull out there. So I think it's incumbent on all of us to be very critical and skeptical of what we see, read, view, and just weigh everything judiciously and not, hop on some bandwagon or immediately share something unless you've really weighed it carefully and be critical. I think there's a big difference between, and I teach this actually in my principles of journalism class, there's a big difference between skepticism and cynicism. Skepticism is which I think we all should be. You know, in the Bible, in the book of Acts, it talks about the Bereans, and they were skeptical. They checked to see what they were being told and preached at, and they went back to the Bible to see if it matched with what was there. And I think it's important for all of us as information consumers to be skeptical, which means we rigorously check what we're being told against other factual, authoritative, reliable sources of information. That's rigorous. That's not lazy. That is healthy. As opposed to cynicism. Cynicism is lazy and arrogant, and where cynicism starts from a place of there's nothing you can tell me that I don't already know, right? Or I'm automatically dismissive of you because you lie. You're a liar. I don't believe you. I don't want to listen to anything you have to say. And I think that's where we do a disservice to ourselves. So skepticism is good. Cynicism is not good. And I think if we're healthy and skeptical about what we read and counterview and check it against other reliable sources, we will serve ourselves, our families, our communities well.
That is so well said, because what I'm hearing you say is that a cynic is probably skeptical to some degree, but a skeptic is not necessarily cynical. Because
correct, yeah, exactly. If you're skeptical, you're dubious of what somebody's telling you, but you don't just dismiss it. You take the extra rigorous step of going to check it out. And I think that's where a lot of people miss the boat. First of all, there's so much information coming at us. It's like drinking from a fire hose all the time, right?
Right,
so
right.
How can you obviously swallow it all, right? But I think it's easy to just fall into a position where we discount or dismiss any source of information just because I think people, a lot of these days, especially with social media, are looking for affirmation and not necessarily information. So you're bringing, I already have my opinion set on whatever the topic is, and you can't tell me any different, right? So if it doesn't affirm what I already believe, it's of little or no value and I discount it. Whereas if you're skeptical, you're looking for information, you take that information and you weigh it, you judge it, you check it. And that takes some burning some brain cells, you know?
That is for sure.
Yeah, instead of just dismissing it out of hand because you think the person has impure motives or they're wrong or they're trying, and you're right, they're wrong, and end of story, and you move on. I teach and I really believe there's a really strong difference between skepticism and cynicism, and I hope my students are healthy skeptics and not cynics, because mm-hmm. when you're cynic, you become bitter, you don't grow. You stop growing intellectually, educationally, and that's not good.
Well, that is very helpful, and that's a great illustration to give us all. You know, one of the things that I have appreciated with the younger generation of today, the millennials on downward, there is such a desire to be real with so many young people today. And along with that, there is a desire to, I guess, reject what is viewed by them as not being sincere, not being honest. And sometimes that can be a problem because they can, in some ways, become a bit cynical along the process. And I think it's human nature for any of us. We live in what's this, now we're even post-postmodern, I think there's a widespread rejection of old and long-held values. Are you seeing the effects of this pandemic and all of the things that's going on? Are you seeing among today's young people a rejection of what they're hearing about it? Is that happening at all?
Oh, I encounter students who are cynical all the time, which is why I address this whole thing in my course, because that's not good. First of all, and this is, I'm going to sound like the old man, get off my lawn. You haven't lived long enough to be cynical. I mean, if anybody should be cynical, it should be a 59-year-old guy like me, you know, who has some mileage, you know. I meet cynical young folks all the time. And if I get a chance, I try to get them to move from that space to a more, what I think is an intellectually healthy space of, yeah, be skeptical, be dubious, but check it out. How do you know unless you check it out? Mm-hmm. You can't just dismiss something out of hand, because you think cynically that all people lie to you, right? Mm-hmm. So they lie all the time, so I don't believe them. That's not healthy. I mean, how can you have any kind of relationship with anybody if you're just cynical all the time?
That sounds like a recipe for a lack of joy, doesn't it?
It really does. It really does.
You know, what changes do you think could happen in the world of journalism as a result of the coronavirus?
Oh, that is so interesting that you brought up, and I'm so glad that you did, because the pandemic has changed so much of just the way journalists do their jobs and have had to do their jobs, because just like everybody else, you know, if you watch a newscast or especially a local newscast, everybody's reporting from home.
Mm-hmm.
People are having, you know, we have a three-pronged primary methodology for doing journalism. Number one is you interview experts, people who are in the best position to know the most about whatever the topic is. Most of the time, and the best way to do that is to do it face-to-face. Well, hey, we can't do that anymore. So we're doing it by Zoom. We're doing it by, if it's on the street, you see people using these big, huge, long boom microphones. Reporters are standing, you know, at least 6 feet away from the person they're interviewing. They're using, you know, telescopic microphones to capture the audio. It's totally different, you know. And then documentation is the second prong. So, you know, accessing public records. I'm on a project now where we look at public records a lot. I used to go to City Hall to get them. Well, you don't go there anymore, because City Hall, you know, a lot of those spaces are, if not closed, they've restricted access and hours and things like that. So that's changed. And then direct observation. Well, how much can you observe from your bedroom, you know, from your mm-hmm. living room? So the whole aspect of journalism, of being on the scene and being on site, is different now. If you look at the news conferences that you see every day, whether it's the mayor or the governor or the president, you know, all the reporters are having to be at least 6 feet away from each other and managing that whole situation. So this has changed the way we collect and gather the news. What's interesting to me is how the public has responded to all of this. And last, just a few days of days ago, May the 8th, the Pew Research Center, and I love Pew Research because it's based in Washington. It's a social science organization that tracks all kinds of trends in American society. They're nonpartisan, they're nonprofit, they're non-advocacy. In other words, they don't take any policy positions on anything. They just they scientifically query the American people as about whatever the topic is of the day. And on May the 8th, they issued a survey of a statistically sound sample of almost 11,000 of Americans of all political persuasions, different socioeconomic groups, and asked them, how's the news media doing, you know, during this pandemic? What's your thought and your impression? And the results are kind of interesting. Most Americans, according to this survey, about 59%, say the news media are providing them with the information they need about the coronavirus. Only about half, which is interesting, about half of Americans say that the information they're getting is largely accurate, with a mixed bag of the rest of the half saying, well, it's mostly inaccurate. Some saying it's a mixed bag of accurate and inaccurate information. About half say that the coverage has been helpful to the country. But it's also interesting that 71% of them said they've had to intentionally take breaks away from the news just for their own mental health, just because if you watch or listen to too much of it, you would feel desperate and hopeless. So 71% of Americans in this survey said they've had to take a break from it.
Yeah, there's like a fatigue factor from hearing about all the news about it.
Yeah, but also 92% of these folks said that they have been following news about the pandemic very closely in their own lives from the sources that they consult, whether that's local news, national news, or a mix of both. So Americans are tuning in, but they're also, you know, 71% of them saying, hey, I also have to tune out just so I don't go crazy. The other piece of this, if I can, and then I'll shut up and we can talk about it. It's in the broader views of the American news media continue to be very sharply divided in this country and tending toward negative. When you ask Americans about the role of the news media and the role that the news media plays in the country, they're consistently positive about it because they get the First Amendment, they understand it, they appreciate it. But when you talk about the confidence that they have in the news that they're consuming, it's really split. About 48% have a fair amount of confidence, while about 52% say they don't have a whole lot of confidence mm-hmm. in what. And I think that's a big problem for us as journalists. I think it's a big problem for us as an industry that we have to continue to do better. We have our work cut out for us. And people appreciate that we're there, but they need to have more confidence in what they're seeing and hearing and viewing, at least as they expressed in this survey that just came out from Pew last week.
Well, it certainly is not going to be any time soon that America would go back to that level of confidence that, let's say, Walter Cronkite would have enjoyed back in the 70s, even the late 60s with the Brinkley Hunt, Brinkley, what is it? David Hunt and Brinkley.
Yeah, Huntley
Brinkley. Yeah. There it is. I'm going back a long time. There's a lot of our older listeners that may get that, and the rest of them are going to go, huh? Who? Yeah, that's right. Those reporters were really trusted in an unprecedented way. But I think our earlier discussion about skepticism and cynicism has long since eroded away those levels of confidences. And so and we are living in a different world. Like you said, a lot of people get their news from other sources other than the networks these days. Mm-hmm. And there's, by and large, it's a different world. I mean, even the world of podcasts, crying out loud, a lot of people would say, I get my news from my favorite podcast. And that is going to be as potentially wide across that spectrum as you could ever imagine.
It's a good thing. I mean, I don't want to go back to the days where there were just three channels or four channels. It's a good thing, and it's healthy in a democratic republic such as ours that people do have lots of choices, and there are lots of voices. I think it's just up to us as consumers to be discriminating in how we consume those things. And as far as, you know, as I'm a traditional journalist, I was a newspaper reporter for decades, an editor for decades. And so, you know, this is an industry and a profession that I deeply believe in, but we always constantly have to get back to our roots, constitutionally and historically. I mean, in my principles of journalism class that I teach, it's the largest class that I teach at UCF, you know, first principles are important. And I start the course and I harp on and continue throughout the 16 weeks of the course that it's so important that we stay centered on what I call our Madisonian role. I mean, James Madison, he was the chief author of the Bill of Rights. The man wrote the First Amendment, which guaranteed, he was the foremost champion of religious liberty, of freedom of speech, and freedom of the press in our country's founding. I mean, this is the man. So what did he mean by freedom of the press? And that's what we constantly have to go back to. And what Madison said and what he was a proponent of was that the freedom of the press is that right of freely examining, and I'm quoting him here, is freely examining public characters and measures. In other words, public officials and public policy, and free communication among the people about those things, which has ever been justly deemed the only effectual guardian of every other right. So the reason a free press exists in our country is to freely examine and scrutinize the people who have the power in our country to exercise that power. We give them at the ballot box to make policy. We surrender our tax dollars to them. How are they spending them? So I think we constantly have to get back to when people trust us most, speaking of us as journalists, they trust us most when they perceive we are looking out for their best interests, when they feel like you are being their champion. In the moment they don't feel like you're their champion anymore, that you're championing some other cause or some, you're championing some other group, or you're championing some other pet project beside ultimately the public interest, that's when they begin to lose faith in you. Mm-hmm. So we have to stay centered on that Madisonian role of our watchdog role of public officials at the local, state, federal level, and do it fairly and aggressively and honestly so that people have a higher level of confidence in what we do.
Well, in that, I've got 3 minutes left, and that is so helpful. With that in mind, that effort to regain trust that, in my mind, I think that, generally speaking, was lost a long time ago among a lot of people. When you talk, and your job being a professor of the journalistic future, if you will, you're teaching kids that are going to take on the jobs that are out there. What advice do you give them to work toward regaining that kind of journalistic edge where people are listening more with skepticism, but not with cynicism? What would you say is the number one thing that you can pass on?
I start, number one, with humility before the facts. Facts are not conservative and they're not liberal. They're not Republican and they're not Democratic. And we're, our, you know, people like to say that this is, we're as polarized as we've ever been. And I don't buy that for a minute. We are deeply polarized, and our politics do seem really poisonous. But I mean, when Madison was president, you talk about polarized, people were walking around with pistols and would get in duels with folks who who were of different political, you know, persuasions. So, and then we had a civil war where Americans shot at each other and killed each other, 600,000 of us, you know, over politics. So we are nowhere near that, but we are deep. We have a deep partisan divide. And so I think it's incumbent on all of the folks that I teach that would be journalists that you have to have humility before the facts. You have to present facts in context. I have a really good friend named Al, whose wife is also a minister, and he has a saying that facts without context is a half-truth. If you don't provide facts with context, and if you take facts out of context and you don't tell the whole truth, that's when people aren't going to believe you. So in the pandemic, it's important to report not just the infection rate, but the recovery rate, right? So that people have context for the information that they're receiving. So be humble before the facts, don't go beyond the facts, and provide facts with context, which means telling the whole truth, which means checking your own biases at the door, which means if you have a bias, going against the bias and doubting your own self and your own biases, to go out and seek information sources that would run cross currently against your own biases, so that you do a check on yourself, right? So that you are making every effort that you can to present and the truth and facts within the context, so that we are best serving our communities. It's all about the, providing information, reliable information to our communities, so they have the information they need to protect themselves and their families and get through something like this pandemic in a healthy and safe way. And journalists are a big part of that, but we have to do our jobs effectively so that people do have confidence in what we're reporting.
It's, I'll tell you what, you can add humility to just about any topic and it becomes a better topic. It becomes, yes, it's such a wonderful character trait that we all need more of. And Rick Brunson, you have it, my friend. Thank you for being on my program today and for your helpful insights. It's always great to hear from you.
Mike, thank you so much for your kind invitation to have me on. It's always good to be with you. I have nothing but love for you and Cindy and your family. You guys have raised some amazing, compassionate, empathetic girls, your son, just great people. And your wife did a fabulous job as the chief educator of your home.
Yes, I say amen to that.
But love you guys, and thank you so much for having me on.
God bless you. And friends, thank you for being with me today on Afternoons with Mike. We'll catch you next time here on The Shepherd.